Chapter 4 Giles was up early on the following morning, a rarity for him, though unavoidable. He lay in bed wide awake for a good hour before giving up, mind running in circles like a centrifuge. Glancing at the clock on the side table, he saw in the darkness that it was 4:13. He sighed, got up, used the toilet, and brushed his teeth as quietly as he could before letting himself out of the bedroom. He spent the next few hours in the sitting room making occasional trips between the coffee pot and the writing desk, devoting the rest of this period to the machine. He had opened the curtains for the morning light, desiring some visual cue that would tell him when it was time to shower and get ready for the day. The screen of the laptop bathed him in a pearlescent glow, and as the sun climbed over the horizon to warm the new day, he noted the environmental change only through the perception of an annoying glare somewhere off to his left. When the laptop clock said 7 o'clock, he rose from the desk and returned to the bedroom, having not looked through the window even once. He went through the morning routine as quietly as possible, but still managed to awaken Annalise in the process. She harrumphed as she rolled away from the light of the bathroom, pulling his pillow over her head. When he came to kiss her goodbye, she resisted his attempt to draw the pillow away, and beneath it, he saw a sharp line drawn vertically between her eyebrows. He knew that line very well. It was a line that said, no. He kissed her forehead, really just a brush of the lips, and whispered, I have to go to work, babe. She nodded softly. What is this anyway? You're always up before me. A hand crept from beneath the blanket to shield her mouth.
I'm on vacation. Sleeping.
He laughed as quietly as he could, kissed her again, and left. There was a different person at the front desk, this time a woman with red hair and a face notable only for its forgettability. He asked her to hail him a cab and went to have a seat in the lobby. The day was well on its way by the time he had composed himself in the chair. A steady stream of men and women in suits both entered and exited the building. Sometimes they glanced at him as they passed, though this did not occur often. Mostly they just kept their eyes on their screens, dialing numbers, checking messages. Sometimes they would ricochet off each other like unguided pinballs, excusing themselves with hardly an upward glance. Watching them, Giles wished for a hat, yet such a thing would have only drawn more attention, being out of place with his own suit. He wondered if he could get away with sunglasses, but decided he might look odd wearing them indoors. The doorman soon entered to advise Giles that his cab had arrived. He settled into the back seat and greeted the driver, a turbaned man with a gorgeous, luxuriant beard.
Where are we going, sir? Asked the driver.
There was real music in his voice, and the sound of it made Giles smile. Corner of Nassau and Pine, please. The driver nodded and tapped the screen on his center console. A timer began to tick away the seconds. As they maneuvered, expertly it seemed to Giles, through the morning traffic, he looked out his window at the action of the sidewalks, the press of people moving purposely through their mornings. He noted there were far fewer looking at their phones now. Most of them seemed to be engaged in calls, holding the devices to their ears or speaking into thin air, as though communing with imagined spirits existing only in the universes of their minds. He saw a smattering of masked faces in the crowd, heads directed either intentionally or unconsciously at the pavement. He glanced up at the darting constellations of machinery. As they flitted from place to place, he imagined they too had their destinations, and that they perhaps thought distractedly of other tasks queued for pursuit, things to be accomplished later in the day before they could return home and rest. Nassau was a deep alley walled on either side with a riot of classical architecture rammed into the newer, featureless smooth boxes of the modern era, pushing shoulder to shoulder for dominance and reaching into the sky for the glory of their respective kinds. There was a suggestion of violence, he thought, in their proximity, each to the other, as if two worlds sought to strangle each other in a contest for space. The effect should have been jarring, and so it was. Yet the discomfort derived from the realization that for this city, the war of styles was appropriate and attractive. There was a rightness to the disparity, a correctness in the noise that could only be New York, down to the square bricks laid in the street God only knew how long ago. Perfect squares that had long since ceased to be perfect, worn to roundness over generations by the feet of the unthoughtful as they bustled to their most critical of destinations. On the corner, Giles saw a squat, beige building composed of huge stone blocks with a line of enormous columns barring the entrance. It reminded him of ancient Greek architecture, and he fell in love with it immediately. He drifted through this strange world, near entranced, until he found the building he sought. He followed the signage within, discovering the proper floor eventually with the proper faction of suited people who all looked so much alike to him, and checked in at the front desk. The receptionist made a quick call, spoke into her phone a few moments, and then said, "Mr. Ross should be out any moment, sir. Would you care to have a seat?" She gestured to a small waiting area dominated by several oversized leather chairs. Giles had not fully distributed his weight to the seat of one of these when the man whom he remembered from the TED Talk strode down the hall. He had aged since the recording of that old video. Face more wrinkled, hair more gray. "Dr. Guittery," he called, extending a hand to shake before Giles could rise. "Giles, please," he smiled, shaking awkwardly as he stood from the chair. "Giles it is, then, and you can call me Kevin as well." Giles nodded and was half-pulled, half-guided toward the hall from which Kevin had emerged. "Did you have the chance to fill out the initial NDA?" asked Kevin, his hand held out to show the way. "I did. It should be in somebody's inbox, I suppose." "Good, good. I'll get with HR and confirm. Just this way. There are a few more niceties to run through with legal. They tell me it's not as bad as financing a house, but then I've heard it comes pretty damned close. I hope you'll bear with us." "Of course," said Giles. "We do something very similar with vendors at my company as well." Kevin perked slightly at the use of the word vendors, then shrugged with a single shoulder. "Well, let's get it out of the way then. After that, we can, hell, it's really frustrating. I want to dive right into it, you see. Look, just head on through that door, give them your name, and sign your whole life away, okay? There's a lot to discuss. They'll call me to come collect you when you've finished." The process turned out to be as onerous as Kevin had suggested. It was striking just how similar it was to purchasing a house, with a lawyer sitting next to him at the table pointing at various signature lines to describe what the verbiage meant. "This part just states that you agree not to use any of the technology or techniques you're exposed to here for the purposes of direct competition with Anagnorisis Technologies for a period of 5 years after your contract is terminated. This section acknowledges that you'll be subject to legal action should you expose any company secrets to an outside party. This statement and the 3 addenda following indicate that any work you do under contract for Anagnorisis Technologies becomes the intellectual property of Anagnorisis Technologies. Please initial, sign, and date right here, Mr. Guittery." As he signed the last page, the lawyer who sat with him picked up a phone and said a few words into it. Kevin Roth materialized a few moments later to collect Giles, smiling warmly. Giles shook with the lawyer, feeling dazed, and Kevin led him down another hallway to a long, window-lined conference room appointed with furniture that Giles had come to think of over his career as intimidation chic. A few different people ringed the long, glass-top table, all of whom stood when he entered the room. "Here he is," Kevin proclaimed happily. "None the worse for wear after the lawyers tapped a vein, eh?" "Giles, I'd like to introduce you to a few people. The lady up at the head of the table is our CEO, Linnea Nilsson. To her right is Marcus. He's the chief project engineer on the, little program you'll be sitting in on. I think you'll be interfacing with him the most while you're here with us. To the opposite end is Ross. He's one of our few principal engineers at Anagnorisis. And I suppose you know who I am by now." He let the last bit trail off in a smile, pleased either with his own affability or with Giles's obvious reticence. Giles stepped into the room and made a circuit of the table, shaking hands with and bowing slightly to each person he encountered. He was impressed in a distracted fashion that Linnea possessed a grip of iron, careless in its application, and he saw in her eyes that the strength he felt was not directed as a mechanism to earn her place among men. He had a sense that he felt strength only because it was an aspect indivisible of her nature, like some people possessive of a high voice or quick laugh. He was put off balance further when she and Ross excused themselves and left the room following their introduction. They had only been there to have a look at him, it seemed. Several meanings could be gleaned from this. Giles suspected he might be able to dream up one or two. The good mornings were concluded with the efficiency of a German assembly line, and Giles took a position at the table opposite Kevin and Marcus. He tucked his laptop back behind a chair, and saw how all was visible beneath the surface of the glass tabletop. He shifted in his seat and reminded himself not to scratch himself in ways that would embarrass. Looking closely at the surface, he realized he could detect no smudge or print. He crossed his fingers over his chest, resting elbows on his chair's armrests. Kevin asked, "Do you want to get started, Marcus?" The other nodded and then regarded Giles without comment. It started to be uncomfortable, but before Giles could speak, Marcus said,
"I need to make a few things clear, Giles. I'm not good with people. I suppose you could say that I'm a bit of an introvert. I come off as abrupt, even terse most of the time, and most people who don't know me don't know how to take that. It's a thing I've come to learn, and you'll learn it too soon enough. I'll ask you not to take anything personally. There's no reason to suspect that I'm annoyed with you or that I dislike you, understood? You'll know when I don't like you. I'll just tell you."
Giles swallowed and nodded.
"That's the deal. Thank you."
Marcus turned on an overhead projector with a remote control, bathing the far wall in slowly intensifying light, retrieved a manila folder from a chair positioned behind him, and dropped it on the tabletop with a clap. He opened it, pulled out a thin stack of papers, flipped through a few of the pages, and then read, "The problem with strong AI."
"Oh, dear. So the thing you have to understand about that," Giles began. "You wrote this when you were how old?"
14.
14,
Marcus repeated. He scrolled down a page with a fingertip, stopped, and began to read again.
"If it is true that the human brain is little more than an organic processor, why is it that we cannot create general intelligence by design, given that our own intelligence developed naturally by a casual chain of accidents? Should we not be able to achieve the end state that much faster if we are actually trying to get there? The fundamental problem in the pursuit of a true artificial entity lies in the differences of function between the human brain and the silicon machine. Chief among these, that the portion of the silicon machine that processes and the portion that remembers are separate structures. This is not so in the human brain. The structures that process and remember are indivisible."
He stopped reading and looked again at Giles. Giles cleared his throat and said,
"There's obviously a lot of guesswork being done there."
"How so?"
"Well, as it relates to the human brain, we still don't know for sure how any of that works, especially memory, right? We have some gross observations, but that's about it. We think, for instance, that certain parts of the brain are responsible for specific types of memory storage only because some doctor somewhere cut a piece of somebody's brain out to treat a neurological ailment, finding after the fact that those specific memory types could no longer be stored or accessed. On one hand, that does tell us something, but honestly, cutting pieces of brain out and observing how behavior is impacted?
Not a fan, eh?" Kevin smiled.
"It's just short of leechcraft."
Marcus nodded thoughtfully and glanced back down at the paper. As he scrolled further with his index finger, Giles realized that he was being interviewed for whatever work it was they wished him to do. Marcus stopped at another page and read again.
"Leads to the conclusion that general intelligence cannot yet be achieved with today's state of technology, given that it lacks the complexity required to achieve the only expression of consciousness we as the progenitors of such an intelligence are likely to recognize. The first true thinking machine will therefore be composed of an architecture fundamentally different from the systems we know today. Lacking a high-level programming language complex enough to satisfy the goal, the idea of programming true intelligence must be abandoned outright. It must be cultivated over time, like our own intellect, both to allow said complexity to grow itself, given that we cannot define it, we must abdicate the responsibility to do so, and for allowing ourselves to recognize the newly formed conscious being when it finally emerges. The intelligence must be like our own, or as like to our own as can be, or we may fail to identify it when it presents. We are then left with building a low-level simulation of the human neocortical structures in the hopes that the desired function presents as an emergent phenomenon. Such a construct would therefore require a physical aspect capable of interacting with the surrounding environment for those reasons already explored, as well as a sublayer of instinctive drivers, as in bios, that spurs the system to interact and explore. Pleasure, pain, and so on must be represented, or simulated at the very least, to the greatest degree possible. Sadly, as has been discussed, the classic silicon system lacks the requisite complexity for the task. It is therefore incumbent upon the progenitor to explore a different medium. Likely candidates include biological platforms capable of processing and storing information naturally, such as certain species of fungus, or even portions of existing gray matter, perhaps harvested from a deceased donor. Marcus ceased reading and put the paper on the table. "A lot of interesting thoughts there," he said. "Admittedly rambling and disjointed," Giles laughed. Marcus nodded while shrugging dismissively. Kevin said, "And yet it was a big part of what got you into college ahead of schedule. 17 or thereabouts? Did you know that would happen when you posted this paper online?" Giles shook his head. "Young people often think that every little thought exercise is a revelation." Marcus snorted. "And yet 2 years after you wrote this paper, a man named Kevin Warwick releases the following." He pressed a button on the remote control. On the far wall, a video displayed showing small, wheeled devices moving to and fro over a floor. They impacted various obstacles, including each other, rotated, and pursued differing directions, juddering about, seemingly at random. "Were you aware of this video?" Marcus asked. "Yes, a friend sent the link to me some time ago. We had quite a laugh over it, actually." Marcus paused a moment, looking at him, and said, "Those little robots are being controlled by neural networks grown from the cultured brain cells of lab rats. They apparently displayed learning behavior, and even, as claimed by Warwick, aspects of unique personality." "Yes, it really was rather impressive," Giles nodded. "Your paper predicted this." Giles winced. I wouldn't categorize it as that great a leap of intuition." Kevin laughed and said, "You wrote it when you were 14, Giles. Know what I was doing when I was 14? I wouldn't want to say here. Perhaps over a beer sometime. I wasn't writing academic papers, though." "So," Marcus pressed on, "you entered college at 17, pursuing a major in psychology. You appear to have come rather close to completing your first degree, then abruptly shifted majors to computer science. Why?" Giles nodded. He had been asked this question before. "It happened during a class project, really. Or rather, that's when the realization hit me. I was becoming less enamored with the field of psychology as I learned more about it. I found it to be too non-deterministic. A lot of theories with a lot of wiggle room that allowed for those theories to be wrong half the time while still being right on paper. The underlying core of psychology, that is, the study, remains very interesting to me, even so. It's just all of the constructs we've built up around it. I found a lot of it to be tedious. So, what actually happened was that we, that is, a small group of students, were conducting a study for a class, more to go through the exercise itself than to actually learn anything of note. We were in the process of analyzing large population samples, which, I'm sure you know, requires a great deal of statistics. As we went, I started building predictive models using data we'd already captured, first in programs like MATLAB, before branching out into other industry standard languages. And I guess you could say that I fell in love with that activity, that process of building complex mechanisms from the ground up, logical systems that just run like clockwork. I finished out the semester and changed my major shortly after. Thankfully, a decent amount of what I'd done up to that point was fairly transferable, within the realm of general education, obviously." Marcus had looked back down at his stack of paperwork during the explanation, so Giles shifted his attention to Kevin for the remainder. Almost as the last word escaped his lips, Marcus grunted, "You had your doctorate at age 22. "Well, yes, but it wasn't medical, so it hardly counts," Giles smiled. "I see. And by extension, I suppose you're equally willing to discount Kevin's PhD as well?" Giles choked and spent the next several seconds coughing violently. When the fit passed, he said, "Excuse me, that line usually goes over a lot better at parties." Kevin began to laugh. The sound of it was warm and honest, and he said, "It's okay, Giles, it's quite all right. I'll most likely steal that line from you myself. And Marcus, well, he just enjoys being a dick sometimes." Giles arrested the emergent laugh at his teeth, biting down upon it savagely like it was an animal he sought to throttle. The momentary scowl on Marcus's face told him he had behaved wisely. So, Mr. Not-A-Medical Doctor Gittery, what can you tell us about your work in the Guardian program? Or I guess I'll ask what you're allowed to share with us, Kevin asked. When Giles hesitated, he added, All politics aside, obviously, we're not interested in how it's being utilized or perceived. We're just engineers here, okay? Let's address the question from an engineering perspective. Giles nodded slowly and said, I suppose that's the best way. Honestly, that's kind of how the project emerged. It was just an interesting problem I was trying to solve at the time. We were working on improvements to facial recognition software, you see. One of the things that always bugged me about it was the degree of error introduced into the prevalent algorithms if alignment toward the camera degraded. In other words, if you centered your face well enough, the feature worked reasonably well, but put your face in three-quarter profile or something similar, and you start having to fight with all these point-match errors. So I was working on ways to improve that so we could boost performance. Designing a system tolerant of misalignment creates a faster system overall, you see. I was looking for near-instantaneous recognition from virtually any angle. What emerged was just something I stumbled upon. What we did was redesign the neural network from the ground up, and we added in the capacity to deal with foreshortening. It works the same way we recognize faces as humans, right? For instance, and maybe you've considered this at some point, or maybe not, but that doesn't matter. Imagine you're standing in a large warehouse on an upper level, like a catwalk, okay? You're looking at your workers below on the ground level as they walk around doing their jobs. You're looking for one of them in particular. Are you able to locate that person? Kevin thought about it only briefly before saying, Of course. Why?
I see what you mean, Marcus said. It's a process of interpolation.
Exactly, Giles nodded. You can tell who is who because you're not relying only on a flattened image of a face. You've seen this person's face at multiple angles in your day-to-day dealings, so you know what they look like from different angles. Also, you know how they move, how their body's shaped, and so on. All of this information comes together in your mind seamlessly to help you identify your target. The biggest problem, or challenge, with implementing such behavior in a computer system is that we don't have all that extra positional data on file, or at least we don't always. You have an ID photo, maybe. Maybe a mugshot in profile as well, if you're lucky. So the first thing I worked on was a projective algorithm that could take a two-dimensional image of a foreshortened face, map it onto a three-dimensional plane, and then error-correct for a full frontal rotation. Or, in other words, I can take an off-center shot of a person wherein you see a face heavily corrupted through forced perspective and logically rotate it to a degree that I can print you a procedurally generated mugshot and you'd be able to tell who it was. The fidelity is good enough, in fact, that less advanced computer systems can then compare my generated shot against an actual mugshot and match them as the same person. And I can generate that initial image without having any other imagery of that person on file.
We've done our homework on you, Giles. We know a great deal of this already, but can you tell us how? At a low level, I mean? Asked Marcus.
Kevin raised a hand and said, Insofar as it doesn't violate your IP, of course. We've signed a great deal less than you folks have, I fear.
Giles nodded thoughtfully and said, I think I can say in a general sense.
The broad strokes are that we built the logic first and then spent the next year training the system with as much raw data as we could get our hands on. Magazines, photos, and such, all scoured from the internet with purpose-built tooling, which was quite significant, I'll say. Then there was the 3D work, both with inanimates and living subjects, to teach the system about lighting, shading, angle calculation, projection, and so on. It took us a whole year to get the system up to a level of accuracy that we found acceptable, followed by another 4 months to get that accuracy up to a point where the government was willing to go live.
And those numbers were? Marcus prodded.
We initially set out for 78% accuracy. Our analysis showed us that this was the level at which real-time recognition reached performance factors comparable to the average human. The government wanted to see 90%.
And you achieved this?
Indeed, Giles said. He tried to avoid smirking, but still found the action impossible to resist. It had been a hellacious 4 months.
How did you make up the 12% delta?
Now smiling fully, Giles said, That I cannot share, unfortunately. Kevin laughed, and even Marcus smiled at this.
That must have been quite an exciting time, Kevin said, knocking the tabletop lightly with a knuckle. Giles nodded. And so that works until it doesn't, Marcus said. Hats and masks functioning as they do. Yes, that is a challenge. You have to remember when we first built the system, we hadn't counted on it being used in this fashion. We were just trying to build a better facial recognition platform. And then when they told us what it would be used for, I never realized personally the kind of backlash we'd see. Plenty of cities in Europe are densely populated with security cameras everywhere, and they certainly didn't go crazy over there so far as I know. I sure didn't expect designer masks to become a thing at any point, let me tell you. And so the new voice upgrade will account for that, Kevin said. Yes. It works about the same way, except we adapted the logic to filter out background noise instead of predicting facial structure. You'd be surprised how much overlap there actually was between the two systems, though I can't specify exactly how. Most drone systems came installed with a provisional microphone anyway, so, you know. Kevin nodded and glanced at Marcus. Well, it sounds exciting, as I said, Giles. I think some congratulations are in order for your coming rollout. I'm sure it'll be a success. Thank you. And how are you dealing with the backlash? Marcus asked. It's been a challenge. Impact your private life at all? Yes, it's been a challenge. Care to elaborate on that? No. I've said as much as the topic deserves, which will be sufficient for the purposes of this discussion. Marcus sat up and looked at him with fresh eyes. He looked at Kevin briefly, and then nodded. Fair enough. That's fair enough, Giles. Then the two men looked at each other again and nodded, and Giles detected a channel of communication having passed between them, as indecipherable as thought. Kevin looked at him again, smiled, and said, Well, I'm sure you'd like to know why we hauled you all the way out to New York, eh? I guess it's time we got to the damn point. How much do you know, Giles, about quantum computers?